This is KZSU Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. There are any number of ways to procure food in the animal world, but for the purposes of today's show, I will reduce them to two: the way of the whale and the way of the oyster. The whale travels thousands of miles to find food from cold, high-latitude feeding grounds in the polar regions to warmer, low-latitude breeding grounds, consuming untold amounts of krill and small fish as it moves. The oyster instead lets the ocean bring things its way by cementing itself to a rock, using a special limestone protein to stay secure, periodically lifting its shell to pump seawater over its gills. It takes in plankton and other nutrients with tiny hair-like structures called cilia. For the record, the host of this radio program is an oyster who holds fast to the rock of Stanford University, where the world's oceanic currents bring in all sorts of things for the feasts we share with you, the Brigade. And oh my, look at what those currents have brought us today. Stay tuned, friends. We have an immense whale swimming in the waters of KZSU, ready to share his cetacean song with us here on Entitled Opinions.
That's a beautiful introduction.
My guest today is author and filmmaker Werner Herzog, who, if he didn't exist, would have to be invented. He has wandered the earth far and wide, year after year, decade after decade, making one feverish film after another in his quest for what he calls ecstatic truth. Ecstatic truth is not something you grab hold of, not something you possess or uncover. It's something you experience only through the veils that enfold it. Friedrich Nietzsche makes a pertinent statement in this regard at the end of Nietzsche contra Wagner. I quote, "I no longer believe that truth remains truth when the veils are withdrawn. One should have more respect for the bashfulness with which nature has hidden behind riddles and iridescent certainties. Maybe truth has her reasons for not letting us see her reasons. Maybe her name is, to speak Greek, Baubo." End quote. Baubo was the Greek goddess of mirth and mischief. So Nietzsche goes on to declare, "Oh, those Greeks, they knew how to stop courageously at the surface, the fold, the skin, to adore appearance, to believe in forms, tones, words, the whole Olympus of appearance." If my guests will allow me an opinion, I think Werner Herzog's films offer their viewers, and his books offer their readers, a poetic plenum of surfaces, forms, tones, words, and the enigma of appearances. His films leave representation behind and reveal the extent to which something remains unknown and unrevealed in the lush radiance of the visible world that he brings to the screen. In his book, The Future of Truth, Herzog writes about his open-ended quest for an ecstatic truth that does not lend itself to unveiling. I quote him, "The quest itself, bringing us nearer to the unrevealed truth, allows us to participate in something inherently unattainable, which is truth." There's the pearl in today's oyster. Herzog seeks to make us not the observers of reality, but participants in a truth that pulls us outside of ourselves, a truth that can be drawn near to but not attained. And with that, let me welcome my guest to the program, Werner Herzog. We're delighted that you could join us today on Entitled Opinions.
Thank you for having me back again.
Yes.
I love this program.
Yeah, and we've
good to speak to
We've had two of them before today, and today we're going to talk a lot about the new book that you just published called The Future of Truth. The quote that I just read comes from that book. Beautifully translated, by the way, by Michael Hoffman, the great Michael Hoffman, and published in English by Penguin Press.
A poem, a writer himself, and
yes.
You can tell.
Yes.
Yes.
So the very last chapter of The Future of Truth has only two sentences where you write, "Truth has no future, but truth has no past either. But we will not, must not, cannot give up the search for it." And I'm very intrigued by that statement. If truth has neither past nor future, does it have a present?
Well, that's a strange question, and it's good that you are quoting the end of the book, because, of course, that truth has no past is described in the book. Fabricated lies, fake news exist since we have written testimonies of historical events, beginning in pharaonic times, going to fake Neros who appeared after the suicide of the Emperor Nero, and on and on. Yeah. And, of course, it doesn't really have a future either when we look at AI and what's coming at us. But the key to it is we are not the cows in the field. There's something innate in us that compels us to search for some flickering light. We only probably know the vague direction in which to search. And that's about it. And to give us a dignified existence on this planet, we cannot, we must not, and we will not abandon this quest. So, and it's not only for the poet. It's for every one of us.
Every one of us. So it's in the quest that the closest that
exactly.
we can get to it is right. is in the quest, because you do say that yeah. ultimately it is unattainable.
Yeah. And what is interesting, you mentioned Nietzsche.
Yes.
And of course, Nietzsche was very, very deep into ancient Greek.
Yes.
And etymology. And I would like to point out that in ancient Greek, the word for truth is aletheia. And it comes from the verb lantanein, which means to hide, to cover, to disguise. And aletheia, like pathos and apathy, is the contrary of it, meaning yeah. aletheia means the discovering, the unveiling, the opening up of the curtains
yes.
and reveal something. And it's a very, very interesting take on what constitutes truth. And I say it only in quotes. So we have to touch this word only with a pair of pliers.
Yeah.
We will use it, but we have to give the caveat for the listeners.
Well, in fact, I think a number of the listeners of this program, when you say aletheia, are going to think about also Martin Heidegger, who makes that etymology of truth very important to his philosophy, because he believed that Western philosophy has been so driven to expose and reveal and render accessible the truth. But he says that the lethe, lethe is the hidden and concealed, as you mentioned. For him, truth cannot be separated from that which is also not disclosed.
Yeah.
So there's always something undisclosed, even in disclosure. And I think you're...
Although I have to confess, I have my difficulties with Heidegger or with any completely and absolutely abstract sort of thinking. I have not cracked the Heidegger code, nor have I cracked the Hegel code. It's unreadable for me. There's something where I have like a huge mountain in front of me. I see the contours, and I see there's something profound and solid about it, yet I cannot climb it. Yeah. Yes, I cannot crack the code. But it doesn't matter. I'm a poet.
Yes.
And I'm somebody who is more hands-on and into life. And it's not that I make films in search of truth. I'm a storyteller. So it's life, life, life. Pura vida, as the Mexicans would say. I mean, the rawness, not the purity of life, the rawness, the raw life as it happens. And
the extravagance of life.
Yes, and storytelling, of course. I'm a storyteller. And when there's a big story, I know it instantly.
Well, I think that the viewers of your film are always left with the sense that there's something mysterious, and life in its rawness has something elusive that you can't quite grasp. It overwhelms you, but it's not reducible to explanation.
Yeah. Well, and that's a fascination. And explanation, yes, you have it in philosophy. You have it in mathematics, for example, and even mathematicians would not be able to tell you what truth is. Yeah. Of course, they have mathematical evidence which is permanent within a closed system. And this closed system itself is under question. Yeah. Is mathematics something existing beyond us as certain patterns, rules of the universe, or is it purely man-made? And I think those who postulate that it's man-made are too anthropocentric, because when you look at the spiral nebula, Andromeda Nebula, it didn't wait until human beings started to discover the mathematics of spirals made of Fibonacci numbers. Yeah. So we are not needed to give meaning to the universe.
Right.
And
but is it indeed the case? I think you've declared that your life work from the beginning has been this search for truth, that you've been...
Well, I realized later.
Yes,
but there was always some sort of glimmering sort of quest in me. And I realized it had to do with truth. What was truthful? And probably in my conflict with cinema verite, the so-called cinema verite, which I call the accountant's truth, which is fact-based. Yeah. But facts do not constitute truth. And that's what you find everywhere, not only in movie making. You find it everywhere when you look at the news on TV, or if you look at whatever, wherever you look around, it's always the mistake of believing that facts constitute truth per se. They do not. They do not, because I keep saying the phone directory, which doesn't, I think, exist anymore, of Manhattan, 4 million entries, all of them factually correct, is not the book of books. It is not the book that gives you any insight. It gives not the insight why is Jonathan Smith crying in his pillow every night, and I'm after that one.
Yeah.
And not after the correctness, the factual correctness. And there's something mysterious about truth and something we can't grasp. And I know I cannot give it up. It's inherent in what I do. And I have accepted it as it is, accepted, including accepted, that I will never see it.
Well, okay, so this intrigues me that you say you never see it, because I can follow it to the point where we can't know ecstatic truth, we can't seize it, we can't formulate it, but can we experience it?
Yes, sure. Yeah.
And I believe your memoir about everyone for himself and God for all.
Every man for himself.
Every man to himself.
For himself and God against
When you describe when you were 16 years old in the island of Crete and the looking at the stars overhead and the silvery fish in the sea.
Yeah.
And you had this sense of a wholeness. It's almost like what called the oceanic feeling. You must have been overwhelmed with something that said, this is truth, or this is...
No, not necessarily that this is truth. something that illuminated me, a deep, deep illumination of my place in this, let's say it in an exaggerated way, my place in the universe. Of course, the stars were above me like a hemisphere, and under me, illuminated by strong carbide lights, fish shooting silvery fish, as if the universe was under you as well. And it was a very deep moment of illumination. And I had a clear sense of becoming known. My destiny became known to me. And it sounds very lofty, and touch it with a pair of pliers when I say that. But indeed, it has carried me.
Yeah.
It has carried me in my work and everything, and defeats hardship and whatever came at me.
You wouldn't call it a moment of ecstasy?
In a way, yes. It is probably a moment of ecstasy. I came to this term much later, ecstatic truth. And you can explain it very, very simply. It's not just fact-based. Something where, like in ancient Greek, ecstasis, outside, standing outside of yourself, that late medieval mystics probably had in their faith. Or someone who doesn't care about complete proportions or factual correctness, Michelangelo's. In the Pietà, 1499, yes, the Pietà with the Virgin Mary, with Jesus in her arms. Jesus, when you look, has the face of a tormented 33-year-old man, but his mother is a teenager.
Yeah.
His mother is a teenager. So, and my question is, it struck me like lightning, and I ask myself, what does he do here? What the hell is Michelangelo doing here? He does not give us fake news, or he does not want to lie at us. By modifying facts, he creates something deeply illuminating, because he gives us the deepest truth about the man of sorrows and the deepest truth you can have about his mother, the Virgin. So that's what what is important. And I'm also pointing out something I really love, André Gide, of whom I know very little, the French writer. But he stated once, I modify facts to such a degree that they resemble truth more than reality. Mm-hmm. So that sits in my bones now forever.
Yes.
What an incredible observation
and
attitude.
For sure. And when it comes to facts, I know that there's a certain type of fact which doesn't lead to the truth, the poetic truth or ecstatic truth. But at the same time, we live in a world of facts, and we can't do without them, because if we didn't established matters of fact, we wouldn't know what is fake news and what is what is.
And you do not dismiss facts,
right?
Because facts are very powerful. Facts have normative powers,
right?
So when we have an onslaught of a pandemic like COVID, within 2 months we have new rules: keep your distance, wear a mask, close down the movie theaters, close down public events, and on. So the normative power is very, very massive. And of course, we live with facts in our everyday life. We live with facts when it comes to political life. And of course, everybody is worried about this. And so am I, but we have to find new tools of defending ourselves, new attitudes. And the 11-year-old, they have a way to almost, in a nonchalant way, tell you, oh, don't open this email. It's an attempt to get at
phishing
data or whatever it's called. And they know almost automatically, and they don't worry that much. They it's an almost innate mistrust.
Yes.
And it's good that we sharpen our mistrust more than probably in earlier epochs, because the tools of deception have become so sophisticated. So we have to learn a new way of defense lines against this sophistication. Yeah. And by the way, there's nothing wrong about mistrusting every single email you receive, distrusting every single statement of a politician, distrusting everything that comes at you. You can do that with ease. You don't need to hate the world for it.
Right.
You don't need to hate the world. You just have to be alert, vigilant.
And that is something that the animal kingdom is well aware of, because deception is not a strictly human sort of behavior. Yeah. Deception is used very widely among animals in terms of camouflage or
mimicry and
deception. And I think the animals have a kind of innate mistrust sometimes of what they see, that what you see is not always what you get.
Yeah. There's beautiful deception, for example, by a specific type of spiders. They go and pluck the web of an opponent like a harpist and with that melody attract the opponent.
Yes.
And suck them empty. I mean, this is good stuff.
Yeah.
So even in lowly creatures like the spider, we have the most sophisticated deception and lure and things. So why shouldn't we worry about fortifying ourselves against deception?
Oh. Well, can I read a quote that was tweeted by the Pope just on April 17th, I believe. So recently.
Recently, and yes.
He says the following: when simulation becomes the norm, it weakens the human capacity for discernment. As a result, our social bonds close in upon themselves, forming self-referential circuits that no longer expose us to reality. We thus come to live within bubbles, impermeable to one another. Feeling threatened by anyone who is different, we grow unaccustomed to encounter and dialogue. In this way, polarization, conflict, fear, and violence spread. What is at stake is not merely the risk of error, but a transformation in our very relationship with truth.
Well, that's so well said. I did not read this, but
I have to thank Corey. Corey here, no, is right no, here.
This
he brought it to my attention.
It should be chiseled in stone,
yes,
and put at the entrance of Stanford.
Yes, I think so.
It's very beautiful. And of course, much of it is against the internet, against social media and the bubbles of existence and the kind of echo chambers in which we are moving. I do not say completely we, because I do not enter these bubble chambers, and I don't even use a cell phone. So we have the choice. Everybody says, you are exposed to it. No, you are not exposed if you do not use the social media. Just don't use a cell phone. Use your landline, idiot.
Yeah.
I think
the landlines also go through the internet these days.
It is true, but you don't navigate in bubble chambers.
That's true. It's just
a transmitted word.
Yeah.
So, or music or whatever.
The future of truth is full of wonderful stories and cases. And so could you tell us a story of the pig of Palermo?
Well, the pig of Palermo is an entirely invented story. But it is so obviously so wild. And the story goes, I must say, it's completely invented. Pig at the marketplace in Palermo falls into a sewage shaft. Perpendicular, but it's not round, it's a square hole, and it lives in there, squeezed in there, and people at the market throw some garbage at it and vegetables, old vegetables, and it feeds off it, and after years it acquires a cubic form. And since there is no light, becomes transparent, translucent, and its legs grow into its body. And so when it was finally retrieved, it was like a cube of jello and wobbling and translucent.
And
I don't even know what it has to do in the book.
It has to do with you then relate that to this crazy false expectation that we could ever go to Mars and colonize Mars,
right.
No? Or get to another star system or something of that sort.
Of course, that's nonsense, and we will not achieve it when we traveled to, let's say, the closest star outside of our own system. Yeah. It will be 110,000 years only the way to it. And by the time we will take the forms of our chairs in the space probe, and we will be probably demented, not even knowing who we are, where we came from, where we are going, and why. And, of course, insanity and palace intrigues and rebellions will take place. So it's a nonsensical idea to move, to travel to these planets. A robot is much better. And Mars, I would love to be on Mars, and there will be eventually a handful of astronauts. But the problem is it's very unfriendly there. The soil is highly toxic. You have a lot of radiation. It's like you may lock yourself in your own microwave oven and wait for the impulse. You will be roasted in 2 minutes flat. And there's no air to breathe, no water to drink. Everything unfriendly. And it's nonsense to populate a planet with a million people. It cannot be done because we can't even, until today, bring a spacecraft with astronauts onto the planet Mars. We have not managed, because the problem is a constellation between our planet Earth and Mars in the 4 months or so of traveling have so drastically changed so that the return trip a week
later,
staying on Mars, would be four times as large. How do you bring the necessary amount of fuel with you? Yeah. How do you bring enough oxygen, water, and whatever with you? Yeah. And behind it is the obscenity that we should rather keep our own planet habitable and not try with incredible effort. That is too much for human beings anyway, to make Mars habitable.
Right.
That's what I have against Elon Musk. I'm very much for sending human beings there, two or three of them. I'd love to be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But give me a camera and I'll send you a daily bulletin.
Yeah, and I tend to agree that the real value of an expedition like that would be to heighten the awareness of what a miraculous planet we live on.
Yes.
And to forestall the trashing of our own only habitat. Yeah. So, Werner, I'd want to ask about opera, because here's where, you know, sensibilities are. You're a lover of opera. I'm one of those people that opera just puts me in a state of aggravated anxiety, and I just can't. I'm not an opera lover. What can I tell you? I could go on for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons is because somehow the stories that are told in operas are
petty.
they're so sometimes so ridiculous and improbable, and that, as you say, because you analyze Verdi's opera La Forza del Destino, the story is just so incredibly implausible, and yet it's the music that rescues the absurdity of the plot. And you know, I can understand that music has that power, but I prefer music that is not conjugated with these kind of stories that, for me, drag it down. For you, it lifts them up.
Yeah.
But nevertheless,
strangely enough, these stories, in a way, have to do with the music itself. There's form of art, which is very odd. And I've become somebody who loves opera very late in my life. And what happens there is you have the most improbable stories. In Forza del Destino, the young, beautiful woman falls in love with an Inca prince. We are speaking of Seville here. He climbs into her bedroom, hears a father approaching, and tries to flee, but he's surprised by the father. So he has a pistol in his hand, showing the father that he doesn't mean any harm, throws the pistol to the ground. The pistol discharges and hits the father through the heart. That's only the first 20 seconds. So it goes on for 4.5 hours. It can't get any crazier. So it's against all laws of probability. It's unthinkable. And yet these stories become deeply emotionally true. There's an emotional truth, and it has to do what I call axioms of truth. Like in mathematics, we have axioms. They are the most reduced mathematical entities upon which the entire edifice of mathematics rests. So it's similar with emotions. They are axiomatic emotions, and they do occur most visibly in opera.
Yeah.
It's very, very strange. Yeah. And I am deeply puzzled. What is it? Where does this power come from to overlay the most ridiculous, most improbable kind of storyline and events? Unthinkable even. Completely out of any probability. And yet they make sense.
They make sense. And this emotional, I think you say that emotions cannot be false. Emotions, when they're truly felt, are always true at the emotional level.
Even what I always thought, there's such a thing like false emotions, like this mass display of mourning when Lady died.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of bouquets of flowers outside, I think Buckingham Palace. It's incredible. It's totally incredible. And I always thought this is such a thing like false emotion. I've come to the conclusion that there are no real false emotions. It's a strange thing, and we need much more time to discuss it, but it's the same thing like sometimes in politics. Against all odds, a politician is capable to portray the present time as a time of feel good, of wealth, prosperity, and bliss.
Yeah.
You look in every alley in a town and you see it is not the homeless dwell there.
Yeah. Well, the notion of ecstatic truth, of course, has been with you for a long time. And you have this chapter 8 is all about, it's a rather difficult concept because on the one hand, it seems to exert a force. You quest for it. It seems to have a presence almost like the aletheia, the lethe. Yeah. There's something hidden there, but it has a power to draw and to attract you because you're in search of it, in quest of it. So in my intro, I suggested that, you know, your films are so full of this kind of lush visual poetry and the phenomena of the world, be it a volcano or even, you know, the oil fields with the Iraq war, you know, these surreal landscapes and these, that it's in the actual appearances of what we can access through our perception that these veils, as Nietzsche would call it, that's where a certain kind of truth, it's not where it can be seized, but it's the one place where we can draw near to it is in the world of appearances, the surfaces, phenomena, not by looking for some ideal world behind appearances, but somehow we have to, it's through appearances that we approach this ecstatic truth.
Yes, that's in essence part of what my quest has been. And of course, you have to also bear in mind that there's a certain responsibility. You have an anonymous audience out there. when you're really going wild, when you're going completely and utterly wild in your invention, it's self-evident. But sometimes it is not completely self-evident. I would out myself. For example, in Bells from the Deep about faith and superstition in Russia, there's this famous Lake of Kitesh where after century of Mongol invasions, every year pillaging, murdering, rape of Mongol hordes, finally the inhabitants of the city of Kitesh ask God for rescue, and God sends an archangel who tosses them at the bottom of a bottomless lake. And there they toll the bells and they sing their hymns and they are living there in bliss. And of course, it's in a way a quintessential Russian story. And I filmed at this lake and I filmed pilgrims crawling on their knees and saying prayers. And there was a thin layer of ice. Sometimes there are pilgrims out on the ice trying to catch a glimpse of the sunken city of Kitesh. On that day when I was filming, there was no one. And I hired two drunks from the village inn, and they crawled out, and I pretend they are pilgrims. However, it's not far-fetched because it really happens. But I outed myself. I told the audience, these are hired, paid stooges. And it's good that I tell everyone. The images are beautiful and trustworthy, and Russians who have seen the film like that sequence best of any of the sequences in the film, although it is fabricated or partially fabricated. And it's good that you let them know.
In fact, you say fabrication, stylization, and storytelling, that's the way to bring the viewer closer to participate in this in this ecstatic truth, no? Through stylization. Yeah.
Michelangelo showing the Virgin, the mother of a 33-year-old man, as a teenager.
Yeah, well, in fact, it corresponds to the theology where, as I think you even mentioned, St. Bernard, who has a prayer to the Virgin, says, Virgin Mary, daughter of your own son.
Yeah.
No?
So, Bernard de Clairvaux.
Bernard de Clairvaux. Yes. So in that sense, Michelangelo gives an image of Mary as the daughter of her own son.
Yeah. And of course, factually impossible. Yeah. We are in the realm of poetry, of art.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful that we got it.
For sure.
Can't get any better.
You know, I don't want to end our conversation without asking you about Joseph Conrad, who is an author I know that you admire in many respects. And now we go back to the question of facts. He also had a rather dim view of facts in certain cases where, like in Lord Jim, Jim is put on trial and everyone is trying to ask him about the matters of fact. Why did he jump from the boat, the Patna, on it? In an emergency, and they keep asking him, you know, what happened. But the truth, of course, is so much deeper and uncontainable in the facts. And Marlowe says they demanded facts from him as if facts could explain anything, which they couldn't. So there's this other truth. But I'd like to read you a quote by Henry Thoreau, which has to do with what kind of relationship we can have with facts. Either we can accept facts passively and say that, okay, that's true and that's right, or we can take them inside, you know, the human spirit, and a kind of transfiguration takes place. So this is what Thoreau writes in Walden. He says, if you stand right fronting and face to face to a fact, you will see the sun glimmer on both its surfaces as if it were a scimitar, and feel its sweet edge dividing you through the marrow, and so you will happily conclude your mortal career. Be it life or death, we crave only reality.
Yeah, very beautiful. And of course, he's a poet.
He is a
deep,
poet.
Deep inside, that man is a poet.
But you see what the poet does. I think our conversation is confirming that the poet can take a fact and turn it into this kind of infinite expansion beyond itself.
Yeah. And can I go back to Joseph Conrad?
Yes.
When you read a short story, I love the short stories best. When you read Typhoon and how that typhoon is coming out of silence and stillness. And so if you try to squeeze a weather report out of this, you shouldn't be allowed to even touch a book like that anymore.
Yeah, right.
So it's not the weather report. Read Typhoon. It can't get any better.
Okay, here's Conrad speaking about the kind of art, the kind of writing that he does. And when I read that, I always think of your work as well. When he says, a work that aspires, however humbly, to the condition of art should carry its justification in every line or in every scene. And art itself may be defined as a single-minded attempt to render the highest kind of justice to the visible universe by bringing to light the truth, manifold in one, underlying its every aspect. It is an attempt to find in its forms, in its colors, in its light, in its shadows, in the aspects of matter and in the facts of life, what of each is fundamental, what is enduring and essential, their one illuminating and convincing quality, the very truth of their existence.
You know what? Please give me the text and I'm going to put it under my pillow from now on.
This seems like a manifesto for Werner Herzog's,
I didn't know it, and it's going to be under my pillow from today on.
Well, Werner Herzog, it's been a real pleasure to have you on Entitled Opinions, back on Entitled Opinions, and I hope that you will join us very soon again, because you have all these amazing movies coming out. I know that the most recent one, which I was here at Stanford when you previewed it, is called Ghost Elephants.
Yeah.
Amazing kind of documentary about the search, again, a quest for these very elusive elephants that may or may not be genetically related to a almost legendary species of colossal elusive elephants. So that has come out now recently. It was on National Geographic, but now I believe it's on Hulu.
And Disney Plus.
Yes. Disney Plus, yeah. So it's called Ghost Elephants. Fantastic. And you told me earlier that you've just completed a new film, is that right?
Well, I do have a finished narrative feature film, Bucking Fastered. It's a slip of tongue of two sisters who speak in unison. They're so close. Nobody has seen the film yet, but it will appear at one of the bigger festivals fairly soon, I guess. And I have started shooting in Mexico and in Austria yet another film. So I will start writing a new book fairly soon. So I'm churning out things.
There's
a couple of good stories in me.
And for us, your fans, you know, the more the better. So, keep on. And each one of them, I know that will be a single-minded attempt to render the highest kind of justice to the visible universe. So that's Werner Herzog. So thanks again for coming
on.
Thank you, yeah. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. Thanks for listening.